This week on the show, Cablevision and ABC meet at the OK Corral. Virgin America stops flashing, the iPad gets wired, and the Hurt Locker gets a little hurt of its own. Right here on This Week in Media, number 174. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. And this is Alex sitting in for Daisy. She is taking the week off. I don't really think she has any good excuse, but she's just not here with us. We also, of course, have one of the usual suspects here. We've got Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Alex. How's it going?
Where are you today?
I'm at home today. I had to run out to Malibu to meet with some producers that I'm consulting with. These are like big time movie producers that want to get into web video. And then I had to like race back to my house, which is like an hour away. So, but I made it. I'm here.
Excellent. And also on the show today, we've got Larry Jordan. Hey, Larry.
Hello there, Alex. How you doing?
Good. Where are you coming in from?
Los Angeles.
Oh, very good. And also, I believe from Los Angeles is Mark Frauenfelter from Boing Boing.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
Yep.
Good.
I'm here in Los Angeles.
You are in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you in the Boing Boing Studios down by the beach?
No, I'm not. That's Shenny hangs out there.
Yeah.
And I'm in Studio City near Universal Studios, if you know where that is.
Yep. Very, very good. Excellent. And we've got a lot of news, so I am going to jump right into it. One of the big things, of course, for media folks like us was this bit of a tussle that we saw unfold in New York. So this is ABC and Cablevision blacked out. There was a blackout that was lifted just after the Oscars began. So evidently ABC had a little bit of leverage and they used it. So Cablevision customers, got their Oscar fix, but it took a little while for them to get it all sorted out. A lot of this is over these retransmission that Fox is, Fox First did kind of a push and pull with Warner Brother Cable. And so this has been something that is building up between these two. And it was quite a thing to see. So Tim, what do you think is really going on here?
Well, I mean, it's important for both sides to, see how to play hardball here, because the local affiliates, their signal being on Cablevision is huge. And for Cablevision, they don't want to pay any extra money than what they're paying. I think it's like ABC wants them to pay like $1 a subscriber, and that's close to $40 million is, I think, what they're looking for. And
so we're not talking about a 10 bucks here and there.
No, it's a lot of money on the line here, and it's all about the retransmission of a local station, but that local station happens to be the number one local station in the country. So it's worth a lot. It's in a very important, it's in the New York area. There's no other, Los Angeles is close, but that's New York and Connecticut, I guess, as well. Crazy.
Larry, do you think that that this is well-founded? Do you think that the WABC or ABC deserves this extra cash?
Well, there was a lot of discussion in the LA Times article this morning about that. And the problem is that the broadcast networks and the broadcast stations have put themselves into a corner. For years and years, they've released their video without any additional payments to the cable outlets. And the cable outlets have been able to retransmit the signal with no additional money coming back to the networks. The problem is as the network audience continues to decline, their revenue is being lost, and they're looking to find ways of making that revenue up.
And that actually brings us to a question for Mark. Do you think that this is something that is an important change in the industry, or do you think this is kind of the last throes of an older age?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I would have loved to have been there during the final minutes, right when the Academy Awards were starting up, to see what was going on with those Comcast executives who had flown to Los Angeles to work with Disney to make it happen. That would have been really interesting.
It had to have been insane. I mean, it just
this
had all the drama of a good at least evening made for TV film.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, with time shifting, and I watched the Academy Awards with people who are television writers, and someone who is the head of a department for one of the major studios, And we got there and we just, you know, they started recording it on TiVo. So we started watching the Academy Awards like 45 minutes after it started because nobody, not even these TV people, wanted to watch the commercial. So the networks have to pick up the money somewhere. And so, you know, they have some leverage against these cable companies by threatening to pull the feed. That's, you know, that's what they're going to do. I think we're going to see more and more of that because advertising is diminishing.
Isn't it true that this was when this all began, when cable began, the only thing that the networks really wanted to make sure of was that they were on, that they were included in cable. They just wanted to be able to play, make sure that they didn't lose more viewership on it. And now they really are getting to the point, as you said, that they have to find ways to make money in ways other than advertising. Larry, what were you going to say?
Well, two things. You have to look at the fact that cable's been paying money for things like HBO and Showcase for years. It's just that the networks haven't gotten their piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. And to clear up a point that Tim made at the beginning, the cable, Comcast made an initial offer of 10 cents per viewer. And Disney was looking, according to the LA Times, for $1 a viewer. And they've compromised somewhere between 25 and 67 cents a viewer, depending upon which part of the article you read. So I think the bigger issue was not whether Comcast was going to pay money, because clearly they were. It was the amount of money they were going to pay.
Well, and we have, so this is a comment from the IRC that's watching us live. It said, hold the door here, Alex, WABC. This is from Sparky in Corona. He said, WABC and all the other affiliates have had taken the advantage of cable and satellite from extending the range of their signal. What he's saying is they owe the distributors. What do you guys think of that? Craziness. It's a thought. I mean, because the reality is, well, if you look at like a lot of these that used to be local stations are now, you know, national or international stations based on this distribution.
I think there's plenty of arguments on both sides of the fence in terms of who owes who money. But I would say that the traditional business model of cable is paying for content, and they're getting content from the local station, whether it's a local newscast or something else. And they should pay for it. I think the question really is just a dollar amount. It's a business decision, not a philosophical decision.
Right. Who came out the winner?
I want to know who blinked. I want to know who pulled the trigger. Who said, "Okay, I cave."
Well, it seems like I mean, to me, it seems like Cablevision must have blinked. You know, this was I think that this was something that they got put into a position where they had a big show that a lot of people evidently wanted to watch. I have to admit that I was going to watch the Oscars, and then I realized that I'd prefer to watch the grass grow. Then, I can see, you know, it's great to know later what happened, or watch the reviews, but I don't really need to see them do this thing one thing after another unless I have something else to do on my computer. And so, but there were a lot of people that evidently don't agree with me and would prefer to watch this. And this put an immense amount of pressure on Cablevision. Mark, would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a game of chicken. Comcast for a while, from what I read, was that, Disney kept on trying to call Comcast and talk to them and work a deal, but Comcast was just ignoring them, thinking that they had all the power. But really, Disney did, and I think it was around midnight the night before the Oscars that they actually pulled the plug, and that's when Comcast realized that. Cablevision realized that Disney was serious about it, and they actually two executives actually flew out here to Los Angeles, and I have a feeling that Disney came out the winner here, and they haven't really set a precedent, have they? I mean, other stations that air commercials have also been paid to be on cable before, but
the cable networks have been paid for a long time, but what's new are these new redistribution deals that are going on. Now, Fox was really the one that kind of set the ball in motion. So we have Fox, you know, kind of setting up that set of rules, or trying to establish them. And I think that's the issue, is that a lot of these networks are trying to now establish this new rule. And so it's kind of like a precedent in law. It's much easier for them to negotiate the next round of cable back and forth when you have a couple who have already folded. When Warner Cable or Cablevision have folded, as they go into talking to Comcast or whoever, they now have a historical, well, other people are doing it, and now you need to do it. And that's I think we're going to see these showdowns. It seems like what's going to happen is, you know, no one's going to think, we're going to be talking about pennies 5 years from now. We're not going to be talking about whether they do it or not. I think that's the real issue right now.
And so then, I mean, in the end, we have cable bills are going to increase as a result. So what does that mean in the market in terms of competition and satellite, as these other options become more competitive? Who knows? It could be a good thing for people. And, people don't want to watch commercials, so they're going to pay for it one way or the other.
Yeah, and in the short term, it's going to hurt the consumer. But in the long term, it may work out better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so close to the only reason that we... the only reason I think we still have cable is because my wife likes to watch Oprah and I like to watch Alton Brown. And that's pretty much the only reason that we still have it around. So,
but see, I think that makes a good point. And that is that if you have compelling content, whether it's Oprah or other programs, you're going to be willing to pay for it. And what has happened in the past is that we have expected all of our programming to be free. And that business model, as Philip Hodgetts has made clear, has gone away.
It's not free. I mean, I think we pay like essentially $2 a day so that we can watch two shows. It's $1 a day. I'd pay $1 a day for my Alton Brown if it was new every single time, and Carlita would pay $1 a day for her Oprah probably. So anyway, moving on. This is getting more into distribution. Another change of distribution. Virgin America ditches Flash on its site. So this is kind of an unusual turn of events, but you can see where they're coming from. So basically the CIO of Virgin America, and I am not going to try to pronounce his last name anywhere on broadcast. I just looked at it. I was like, I just don't have the guts. But Ravi, and it's a long name, specified pointedly to the iPhone when he said, "I don't want to cater to one hardware or one software platform one way or another, and Flash eliminates iPhone users," which I think is a very interesting take on it. Usually people don't talk about it that way. They talk about Apple eliminating Flash as an option, but they don't think of Flash as eliminating iPhone users. But they said further, the issue is that Virgin wants to be able to allow passengers at some airports to check in using electronic boarding passes. And they're going to want to do it on a smartphone. And, of course, the biggest game in town, especially when you go to if you guys fly Virgin, I fly Virgin a lot. And it's an awful lot of iPhone content. I mean, it's a very heavy iPhone crowd that I think flies Virgin. So they're taking Flash off their site. They're going to replace it with HTML. Here's the question I have for you, Tim. With this kind of news, does Apple really need to ever add Flash when people start caving like this?
I don't think so. And there's a lot of people preparing stuff to replace Flash. You look at companies like MDialog, one of my sponsors, they've got a delivery system so that you don't have to have Flash video on your site. But in this case with Virgin America, it's really about, being able to do that check-in. And for other people, what sites do you have that you need to buy things on? And if you can't buy it with your iPhone, that's a huge wasted opportunity, especially when people have a lot of time on their hands. They can go to any website on Safari on the iPhone or on the iPad coming out, and if it's Flash, they're not going to be able to interact with your website. So that's a big problem.
Larry, do you think that Flash is in trouble?
I think there's two sides to the issue. One is, where's Flash today? And the second is, where's Flash going to be tomorrow? And this really is positioning for Flash tomorrow. Is Adobe is working hard to come up with Flash 10.1, which solves a lot of the issues of processor overhead that we're working with in Flash 10. And we're also seeing the HTML5 spec, which is an open source version of eliminating Flash and giving us interactive content similar to Flash without having to use the proprietary Flash engine. I really think this is positioning for the future. It's not trying to solve the Flash issue for today.
This may be a question for you, Mark. Is HTML5, do you think it's up to replacing it? Do you think that, can people really move away from Flash, or should they?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. From what I've read, my feeling is that Apple is not going to ever want Flash. And so with Boing Boing and Make Magazine, we're really looking at HTML5 as the way to go, because that seems like a safe bet no matter what happens in the long run. It's just go that way. Well, but I have a question. Mm-hmm. YouTube on the iPhone, is that not showing Flash?
Well, no, that's showing H.264. So that has been, but YouTube has been doing that quietly for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So Google has been moving. I think that, we've talked about this on other Twims about the issue that Google and Apple always seem to want to either control or commoditize. Once Google took over YouTube, it's in the back burner. They were kind of reconverting all of the Flash content to H.264. And so what you're seeing, you're not seeing the entire library, I don't think, on the iTube or the YouTube app. But you are seeing a big chunk of it and a growing chunk of it as they convert everything to H.264. But that's what's playing back there.
Okay.
Yeah. So and that's the issue is, and I think that one of the issues that is going to come up with both the iPhone and the iPad is from a company trying to, if you're a company trying to get a hold of a certain kind of consumer, a consumer that spends money freely, you know, obviously iPhone and iPad users are a good example of people who are willing to spend a fair bit extra for stuff that they like. Because it's, you know, they can buy a cheap phone for free for, you know, if all they want is to communicate. So I think that ignoring that audience is very dangerous. They kind of do it at their risk, and I think that's the upper hand that Apple has.
I think it's a bigger question, and that is, why ignore an audience if you just simply restructure how your stuff is programmed and program it as HTML5? You get the benefit of all worlds.
Right.
And if you work with Flash, you lose Apple. So it's like I get everything or I only get some things. It makes more sense to rewrite it in HTML5.
Now, a lot of people will say that the ad networks are a real problem because, like, if you turn – like, I have a blocker on my Firefox and on my Safari called, I think, click to flash. And what it does is it basically just pops up gray screens where all the flash is, and I can decide, I can decide where I want to turn the flash back on, because it just, the load times were making me a little crazy. Click to flash. Yes. What I suddenly noticed was on certain sites how much flash there was. I mean, you know, you just don't notice it. You just see it as images and things are popping up and everything else. And suddenly you realize how much it's part of our ad network. Is this something that's going to be very, very difficult for the ad networks? Because a lot of when you talk to ad networks, and Tim, this is a question for you. When you talk to ad networks, a lot of them will say, you know, well, we just don't have the same reporting status that with QuickTime that we get with Flash. And so Flash gives us a lot of information back that we really need to know how many people are watching and how long they watched and what they watched.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the ad networks went with Flash in the first place instead of going with QuickTime. But Apple went and they developed the QuickTime Adaptive Bitrate Streaming. And so now, if you have that technology like MDialog does, you can put ads every like 10 seconds. And what this technology does, it basically breaks up your video into 10-second chunks. And it checks the speed of your computer or your iPhone or your iPad to see how quickly your connection speed is. And then it delivers video that matches that speed. And it adapts the bitrate as you watch the video. So you can stick anything you want if you wanted to do an ad or you wanted to do an interactive story or if you wanted to do dynamic sponsorships. Mm-hmm. You could put that into your video every 10 seconds. So that's pretty cool. Hopefully the advertising world will glam onto this and start to take advantage of this so that they're not leaving the iPhones and the iPads out because that's a lot more screens for them to attack people.
Well, and speaking of the iPad, we've got a story for you. So the couple of things that are going on here. So Condé Nast, of course, is saying that they have plans for quite a few of or a couple of their magazines to start going out on the iPad as soon as it's released. So Wire, GQ, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and Glamour are the ones that they're really looking at over the, I guess, April and through the June issues or through the summer. I guess they're going to be slowly rolling these magazine versions out. Chris Anderson says that, you know, this is the future of magazines. I mean, it's on the tablet, you know, and so he's pretty excited. Chris Anderson, of course, is the editor in chief for Wired magazine, and so so a lot of the Wired staffers have been working on this for a long time. They're putting a lot of the stuff, and we've seen some of the tests for Wired, some of the tests for Sports Illustrated, and it's fairly compelling. So here's the question for you, Tim, to start to kick this off. Is there a chance that, you know, is this the chance for magazines to reset the system? Is this the way that they can start charging for their content? Because they've kind of gotten into this thing where they wanted to keep up. They started to go online and they weren't charging anything. Is this a way for them to get back to that walled garden?
This is huge because with this, the pages won't stick together on the magazines. And that's a big deal for, you know, no. This is a way for them to put the genie back in the bottle. Because, yeah, they were giving away content for free, and this was their first – this is the real chance to start charging. And I think Apple has done a great job of training people on paying for content now. And so this is a great opportunity for all these magazines to start charging for relevant content that people want. I think the big thing, though, is that the iTunes store, the app store at iTunes, needs to have a magazine rack. Because just to throw these magazines in with other apps, it's going to dilute them a little bit. I think if they are put in a magazine rack, they'll get more sales.
Got it. Now, and this is I got a question for you, Mark. As we start to look at this, as the iPad is getting closer to release, and we start looking at a lot of these magazines, I mean, stuff like what Boing Boing does, as well as Make and a lot of the O'Reilly stuff, it just seems like it'd be perfect for this format. Is this something you guys are really looking at?
Yeah, I mean, we're so excited about it, especially for Make.
It just seems like the perfect format for Make. I mean, it just seems to me, it would be the preferred format for Make.
I totally agree, and so we're really looking into that. I mean, how great would it be to have videos in the step-by-step instructions and sound samples, and the tools that you need are just there. So, I mean, this is great, and we're going to move more and more in that direction. And I mean, there's other. Aside from just selling the magazine, we have other opportunities. Like in the step-by-step instructions, we can have the materials list, and you could just buy the whole thing as a kit from the Maker Shed. You know, so there's all sorts of opportunities there by having a digital and, you know, on a mobile platform. So that's something that, you know, this year is our big push, is to make a really cool iPad version of Make Magazine.
Well, and here's the question, and I'll send this to you, Larry. There are two questions in here, and I think we're going to kind of all go around and talk about this a little bit, because this is the big question, or one of the big questions, I think, is number one is I think that you get to a point where the iPad development is more compelling, or the iPad version could be far more compelling than the print version for a lot of magazines, where there's just a lot more content. Now, here's the one, the rub, so to speak, is that does the iPad... A lot of this is going to be custom development for the iPad. So if I'm a publisher and I'm not using Flash and I'm custom developing for the iPad and I start building all these iPad apps and the iPad ends up with 80% of the market, am I really going to bother developing for other platforms?
Well, I think you remember before you were saying that customers that fly Virgin tend to be more affluent and tend to be more iPhone using. I think we can take and extend that a little bit further, is if you have a product which appeals to the 20% of people that don't own iPads, you'd be foolish not to develop specifically for them. If, on the other hand, you have something which reaches a broad audience, then the iPad, if it did have 80% of the market, would allow you to reach the vast majority of your market. You wouldn't have to worry about it. So it really depends upon how you segment your business. If you're after broad market, you'd want to cover everything. If you're after segments, then you'd find the way to reach that segment. And I suspect there'll still be print magazines around in 10 years because some people don't want to do it electronically. I won't say it's the majority of the market, but no media has died since Gutenberg invented the printing press. Why are they going to die now?
Right, right. Because it does seem like it. You always wonder whether it's going to be the end of the magazine stand, but you're right. Nothing dies.
Look at what happened to the film industry when television came out. Hollywood was convinced that television was going to kill film, and clearly you can see over the grosses recently that's absolutely the case.
Right. Now, is the is this a huge opportunity for smaller magazines, for more niche magazines? Do we see this as an opportunity for people who might not have... A lot of the problem is if you want to reach 50,000 people, you'd have to get ready to print 50,000 copies or 100,000 copies. And now being able to put it up on iTunes and pay Apple 30% seems like a pretty good deal. Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. It cuts down that distribution cost. I think it's a win-win. It'll be interesting to me to see, will some templates develop for independent content? So much like a WordPress blog theme, will there be like iPhone app and iPad app themes out there that you can purchase and then load your content into it?
Mark, are you finding it to be challenging to develop for the iPad right now? Is it still kind of your out on the bleeding edge?
Yeah, I mean, for us it is. We certainly don't want to get into the Flash territory for it. So, there's documentation up now on the Apple site about, you know, HTML5 and iPad development, but we're still, you know, really learning, and we're not in a big rush to get out there because, Make is Make. Nobody's going to put out an iPad version of Make before we do, so we're really going to, you know, give ourselves the next few months to get familiar with what it's capable of doing.
Right. I mean, I personally think that one of the things that I'm hoping to see Apple do, and I think that would really cause an explosion, is to take some of the content tools that they have and give us power to develop for the iPad through it. You know,
that'd
there's
be
a lot.
Great.
They've got a couple, and I'm going to just say this on every show until Apple does something. Which is that, you know, they've got these two programs, iDVD and DVD Studio Pro, that make stuff that no one really uses anymore. So it'd be, you know, but they make interactive stuff. So it'd be really great to have those converted to something that would be more interactive.
It does, well, Alex?
Yeah, Larry, you're actually the perfect person to throw this to.
I was just going to say, if you look at iWeb, or you look at GarageBand, or you look at right. iLife or iMovie, Apple has always delivered tools that try to reach the broad market to make media creation easy. It seems foolish to assume that they would not do the same thing to support two of their best platforms, the right. iPhone and the iPad.
Right, absolutely. Tim, what you were going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say what Larry said.
What he said. All right. Also here we've got Netflix's this is the next in the news here. Netflix is eyes the iPhone for movie and TV streaming. So this is according to Wired. Netflix was is still going to require the $9 a month, but you know, they're going to start. Now this also must mean that Netflix is also looking at you know, changing the format, because I don't believe they were using H.264 as the streaming. I want to say it was Silverlight. Yeah. So they were using Silverlight for this, and so again, this turns out to be, you know, we wondered whether who was going to win on this, whether it was going to be Apple or whether it was going to be some of these other companies. But it looks like Apple is almost single handedly wiping out a lot of these other streaming formats. Do you think this was a secret plan, Tim?
I don't know how secret it was. you know, the dark horse here is still the Windows phone coming out, and I think there's going to be a big push for that at South by Southwest, where they're going to try to hit up a lot of influencers. I don't know if they'll be able to do it or not, but there sure are a lot more PCs than there are Macs out there.
Because the Zune did so well.
Yeah, it's huge. Well, you have a Zune, don't you?
I have a Zune, and I like my Zune. I like it a lot. Well, here's what I like. It's not so much that I mean, the Zune is fine.
Feel guilty. That's okay, Alex. Go ahead.
It is. No, the Zune is fine. I like the Zune marketplace. I like being able to download a big chunk of. That's the thing I think is missing from the iTunes store, painfully, is I love someone tells me about a new band, and it happens more with new bands. Big, established, old bands, there's still a lot of holes in the Zune marketplace. But if almost every like brand new band that, you know, it's more alternative or whatever, if someone tells you about it, I can go to the Zune marketplace and just download the album. You know, it's just part of my subscription, and then I can go listen to it. And I love, as far as exploring music, I think Zune has actually got the upper hand. But I have to admit, my Zune player oftentimes runs out of battery because it sat in my pocket for too long. Because I still listen. You know, I still use my iPhone.
There's an interesting thing, Alex. You were asking to Tim about whether there was a secret plan. And I think every company's got secret plans. But if you can't execute it in product and have people buy the product, all the secret plans in the world aren't going to do you any good.
Yeah, it's a pretty complicated little plan. And it'll be interesting to see if they can pull it off. Also in the news, Viacom and Hulu part ways. So Viacom, of course, had a bunch of stuff up there. Daily Show with Jon Stewart, The Colbert Report. So these are all, these are very, very popular stuff that they had up there, and they are taking it down. You know, they couldn't come to an agreement. Is Hulu faltering, Tim?
I think this is more of a test of cable television than it is of Hulu faltering. I think everybody loves Hulu. But except for the cable companies, the cable providers hate Hulu because it's taking their programming and putting it on the internet, and that seems to be a big rub. And so I think there may have been some conflict going on there, and the cable networks are trying to appease the cable providers and you know, put their content back where it belongs and only have it on their own websites.
Now, and this is one of those issues where it seems like, you know, cable companies, you have a situation for them where they have the content providers on one side asking for more money. You have the people who are getting the content going somewhere else, you know, for that content other than going through their preferred pipe. You know, because they're still, you know, a lot of us are still the same, you know, whether I'm watching Hulu or whether I'm watching, Food Network, I still have a subscription through Comcast. Why should they care?
Well, the other thing is, you know, like HBO, I think we're going to see these cable companies do a deal where if you want Jon Stewart on your iPhone or on your iPad or wherever on your laptop, you can do that, but you have to sign up for your local cable provider and you have to subscribe to that channel.
Mark, do you think that's going to work?
Boy, it's hard to say. For me, you know, personally, I like to have more of a simple deal where I, you know, have my cable and I pay for that, and then I do Netflix with Roku. Right. It's hard to say what's going on. I just see that, you know, as audience shrink and become more diverse and interested in smaller genres of media, these large operators who deal in bulk are having a harder and harder time, and they're getting more desperate. So we're going to see a lot more of these, you know, kind of clashes between content providers and, you know, who has the pipes,
right,
things like that.
Well, and Larry, is it going to get to a point where the cable providers are just providing a dumb pipe? This is what they're trying to avoid, but are they going to get to a point where all I care about is the fact that I want a 100 megabit connection, I'll pay you for that, and I don't really care about what else you put on it?
Well, they're doing everything they can to avoid that, but right, also keep in mind that even services like Hulu are not making money. So Hulu has not been profitable since it was started. So I think what we're seeing is a scramble. Nobody has an answer on how we're going to make money on this new world that we're in, and they're trying to figure out the best way to maximize their production dollars. Otherwise, what happens is all the production budgets fall to zero, and we're stuck with reality programming.
Right. So the thing is that there's a lot of specialty. I mean, the niche programming, the one thing that people will I think when we go down this path is that people don't need sometimes the same production value that they would. I mean, there's a lot of people watching, not a lot of people, but there's some people watching this show that don't need it to look like Fox News or CNN or anything else, because they're interested in this specific subject. And I think that in some ways, you know, the idea that it has to be, you know, this big production, I do think that one of the issues is that non-fictional content tends to have an advantage in this area, because you have a lot of people who are just want the content. Whereas I think the narrative, as you're talking about, I mean, it's very expensive to make. It's expensive to write. It's expensive to produce. It's expensive to put together. And so that's the challenge, is how do you fit all that in?
And one of the things my market are people that are doing independent productions, whether fiction or nonfiction, and that employs a lot of people. And and I like having people have work and being able to pay the rent. So I'd hate to have production budgets fall to complete nothing.
Well, and I don't know if they'd fall to complete nothing. I mean, there's, well, anyway, we have.
Look at Jay Leno on NBC at 10 o'clock. NBC made the experiment with Jay Leno at 10 because they could save tens of millions of dollars in production costs for primetime programming.
But I think having production fall down to as little as $1.5 million per show is not nothing. I mean, you know,
you clearly spend it with your show. I mean, I can see the production dollars on screen.
Exactly. The question is whether we need to have that for everything. I mean, that's the issue, is that, you know, a lot of people want something that is, I mean, obviously, I mean, you look at we have to realize, and I think a lot of viewers don't realize that when they're watching Lost, I mean, that is probably, I don't know what the number is for Lost, but it's probably in the $5 to $6 million range per episode. You know, so it's a, you know, and so it's a big, it's a lot of investment, you know, in every single episode to make all of this stuff work. And so it if they want that kind of thing, you're right, they have to do that. If you're the kind of person that just wants the more raw information, then, you know, getting down to $500,000 a show or $700,000 a show might be downright doable. So but I think it is hard for the average viewer to kind of get their head around some of those numbers and where that all goes. Next in the news, we've got this is from the EFFF, I think I added one there, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And this is 12 years under the DMCA. So this is a little bit of a, you know, just kind of looking at where we're at. And this is their argument. So we'll come back to you guys and see what you think of it. But here are I'm going to go through them real quickly and just see what you guys think. Their argument is the DMCA chills free expression in scientific research. It jeopardizes fair use. It impedes competition and innovation. It interferes with computer intrusion laws. Mark, what's your opinion on this this shot across the bow?
the DMCA is just so problem laden that I don't know where to begin. I don't know where to be.
this is where EFF got into it. They started here. This is where they're beginning. But it does seem like the issue that they like specifically with jeopardizing fair use by banning all acts of circumvention, all technologies and tools that can be used for circumvention. The DMCA grants to copyright owners the power of unilaterally eliminating the public's fair use of rights. Already, the movie industry uses encryption on DVDs, has curtailed consumers' ability to make legitimate personal use copies of the movies they purchased. So that's an example. I want to make a copy. I don't want to have the plastic anymore. When all of us grew up, we recorded our albums. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what it happens is. You're breaking the law for doing something legal is the weird catch 22 that they've set up because we are allowed to make backups of the things that we buy. Mm-hmm. That's the law, but then we're not allowed to break the
encryption code
so that by doing something legal we're breaking the law, which is crazy, and it turns everybody into criminals, and it makes people respect good laws less because there's these stupid laws out there. This is the kind of thing that makes all of us at Boing Boing really angry, and we cover this a lot. Thanks to Corey, he's kind of rubbed off on everybody.
He rubbed off on me. I was only on one quit with him, and I walked away just going, "Oh, those guys." So Larry, do you think the DMCA that bad?
To be quite truthful, I haven't run into it. So mm-hmm. I don't have personal experience. I don't have the suffering that Mark had to go through. But I think we're caught between a rock and a hard place. And I look at it from the independent point of view, is that they've invested their time and their money, and they want to make sure that they get their investment back. And if all it was making a backup copy for personal use, that'd be one thing. But the difference between when we were recording albums as kids and when we're ripping stuff now is that we have access now to instantaneous distribution to everybody in the world, which we didn't have when we were laying it off the tape a few years ago.
But is that an availability issue or is it a bad business model issue? Because the argument against that is that you have, 10 billion songs sold.
10 billion.
10 billion.
Okay, just making sure I had the number right.
10 billion sold by iTunes at $1 a pop, $1.30 a pop, something like that. And the issue is that it got easy. Apple made it easy. I don't have to think about what my credit card is. I don't have to think about how I'm doing that. I don't have to think about anything. I just hit, yeah, I want that, I want that, I want that, I want that. I mean, I have a big chunk of that $10 billion. I bought a lot of songs on iTunes, and this was even before, I stopped because it was, I just couldn't deal with the fact that I couldn't move the content around, and then I started up again when they sorted all of those issues out. But the issue is that it became so easy to buy what you wanted and buy what's available that people stopped stealing it or not stopped, but suddenly there was a real market there. And I think the argument against that is that you got to find a model that's going to make and it does what. It seems like, and Tim, tell me what you think of this. It just seems like that, obviously the people that have the business model that was working, that was printing money for them, want the model to stay, of course, identical to what it was before, rather than try to scrounge up something new.
Absolutely.
And what were we going to say, Mark?
Oh, I was just going to say that the problem with copy protection is that it does absolutely no good whatsoever. It just causes a hassle to honest consumers. Because there's somebody out there, no matter how robust the encryption code is, somebody's going to crack it and make it available on peer-to-peer. So free copies are out there for anybody who wants to swipe one and download it onto their hard drive. For everybody else, they have to pay for it, and they have a huge hassle dealing with the digital rights management if they want to change it from one computer to the other or a device or watch it on TV. And so it really does no good whatsoever. It's just it's a waste of people's time.
Course, the other argument like that is usually used by the NRA. only criminals will have guns if we take away the right, and they make it difficult for all the rest of us to have a pistol, and which mm-hmm. Is impeding on my right to carry a gun. But it is true that this is a completely in a lot of ways this is a the subject is it is like when I look at the next generation, when I look at my kids. you know, my kids just don't, they don't think of, because of all these laws, this is exactly what you're saying, Mark, is that because of all these laws, you know, they don't really know what the rules are, because every one of their friends downloads everything that they, you know, that they want, you know, and there was never any rules set up. There was never a new business model. And so the question is can you get that genie back in the bottle? You know, because I have to sit there and have conversations with them about don't download stuff. because I don't want to get the cease and desist letter.
Yeah, you'll get the bill.
I think eventually we're going to have to move to some type of model where we pay for usage. And, you know, just like there's barcode on groceries.
But isn't for video usage?
For video, for songs, for everything. There'll be some type of digital encryption that'll let you move it, pass it, send it to whoever. But you'll just be charged when you do that.
Well, isn't that what's happening when I'm using the Zune Marketplace? I mean, couldn't the Zune Marketplace increase their charge to $45 a month and I could download all the lost episodes that I wanted?
Sure, but what would happen if you pass those to a friend right now?
Oh, you can't. But if you could,
then those friends, if they watched it, would be charged for it.
Yeah. Could you really track it though? I mean, does this get to the point where you just wouldn't just, someone would strip that out?
Well, can you strip out a barcode off of your, something you buy at the grocery store? Sure, you could scratch it off, but they've got to ring it up, you know, to walk out of the store. I think it's not going to happen overnight, and neither did the barcode system. You know, when I was little, there was no barcode system. I think that actually originated from trains in Omaha, Nebraska. That's where barcoding developed, and then eventually it moved into grocery stores.
Yes. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes, but this is like an ongoing development. This ongoing drama that we deal with.
Alex, I think it's a situation where there's no right answer. Is that a strong case can be made that everything needs to be free, and a strong case can be made that everything needs to be locked up. And I think, as Tim and Mark are saying, that it's going to have to be somewhere in the middle, and we just don't know where that middle is yet.
Well, and I guess as a content creator that is somewhat independent, you know, for me, the challenge is I don't really care what the law should be. Or what the law is or what people are doing. My job is to find a business model that works, that gets me the revenue that I need, and I just, without worrying about whether the law is going to protect me. You know, I mean, I have to admit that that's kind of my approach to it is, let's find a good business model. And I look at every business model. I was talking to a filmmaker in Nigeria, which I thought was just fascinating. He said that the big thing is for them is to get all the money back from the film. Now, and this shows you part of the problem. I mean, their films are a lot of times $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 each to produce, and they produce a lot of them, far more than Hollywood or Bollywood. And he said, you got to make all your money back in the first 2 weeks, otherwise the piracy just takes over. You know, but they have a model, and he says, you make all the money, and you sell the DVDs for $2 each, and you get them all out there. But they built a business model that returns it. Now, it's got its own problems, but what's interesting about it is that they figured out a way to make money inside of a inside of a system that is, you know, that runs pretty wild and free in that area. And they got filmmakers making movies, you know, at a different budget than we're used to, but they're still making these movies and they're making, you know, a living doing these, you know, by figuring out a way to work inside of a system that isn't sitting in front of them rather than the way it should be. And the other side of that, which I thought was interesting, is, you know, talking to a filmmaker in India. And they're actually moving to digital distribution because it's easier to get to the theaters faster because they were getting piracy by the time it got to the theater. So when they're sending they were sending the film out, and by the time it got to the theater, it had been pirated or people had seen it somewhere or whatever. So they want to go. They're moving to digital distribution to get it to the theater because there's still a lot of people that don't have any way of doing that. So let's get it to the theater really quickly so that everyone can get a chance to pay their quarter and watch it and get that model. And to me, that's a more interesting solution, which is rather than trying to figure out how we're going to legislate our way out of this issue, is how do we figure out a way to make the system, you know, make what's available work for us, you know, and the technologies that are sitting in front of us. Anyway, that's my soapbox. I'm going to get off now. So the last thing before we run out of time, Oscars. We talked a little bit about the Oscars at the beginning, but was anyone surprised by Hurt Locker?
No, I thought that was that was my favorite movie for the year, so it was great. And, you know, kudos to Catherine Bigelow for being the first woman to win the Best Director Award.
Yeah,
pretty
I thought,
incredible.
You know, what I really liked about the film was that I saw it on a plane, and I just kind of missed it go by. You know, I was like, I watched it on a flight from Dubai or whatever. And,
that's weird. They usually don't show movies with explosions on airplanes. I thought that
was, it was Dubai.
It was Dubai. I'm not going to go there. What I thought was interesting was how much violence it dealt with, but how little violence it showed. And I thought that was a distinct, I thought, a fingerprint of a woman director, you know, that's sitting there looking at what the real story is and the emotion of it, without having to get into the gratuitous people blown everywhere. And I mean, when I really look back on it, because someone asked me how violent it was, and I looked back on it, and I was.
Did you watch an edited version, or did you watch it on your laptop?
Oh, you know, I might have watched an edited version.
Okay.
I didn't watch it on my laptop. Was there a lot more goriness that maybe it was cut out? Because it didn't say it was edited at the beginning. No, it seemed like they cut around a lot of it. Like, it was like you'd see a lot of stuff, but it didn't seem like, you know, in a typical film like that I'm used to. I'm used to seeing, you know, big bullet wounds and lots of pieces. And did I miss it?
Just the films you watch, man.
So I like Man on Fire. That's all I got to say. So anyway, but Hurt Locker was a great, I thought a great film. I thought that worked well. Of course, the producer, one of the things that made a little bit of some hoopla is the producer, of course, got himself into a little trouble.
One of the producers.
So didn't really know the rules of engagement as they relate to the Oscars. So it was doing a little bit of too much promotion. And evidently ended up still getting his Oscar, but didn't end up at the Oscars. So that was his.
Yes, he got his hand slapped.
Yes.
Although there was a lot of discussion in this when this first came up. And what he did is he sent an email out, which you can do, and he promoted his movie, which you can do. But you can't disrespect the opposition. And he said some bad things about Avatar in his email, which is just verboten.
He didn't directly call out Avatar, if I'm correct.
He called it a $500 million movie.
He said, that Hurt Locker isn't a $500 million movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which wasn't, I mean, I don't think that was innocuous. Really a disparaging comment. He was just pointing out, you know, we're one of the little guys and we're under consideration, which is really cool.
Right. Yeah. So anyways.
It's debatable, you know, fine line.
I felt like Precious, you know, didn't get, you know, as much accolades as I thought it was going to get. But, you know, there was some stiff competition.
It was a good
one. Well, Monique got the best supporting actress, yes. Which, you know, she totally deserved that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And now one of the other dramas, of course, with the with this whole Hurt Locker is, of course, an army bomb expert. Somehow the Hurt Locker, evidently, this is alleged, is a woman directed film is allegedly based on a story that was written in Playboy. So that's the story is that Playboy and Playboy Enterprises is claiming that they used a life story from a Sergeant Jeffrey S. Sarver was inspiration for the movie, which did pretty well. And
Alex,
and they're a little
not
upset.
Quite.
Go ahead.
The Playboy published an article from this guy named Jeffrey, and Jeffrey is now suing the distribution company and is suing Catherine Bigelow for saying that when you wrote the script for this movie, you took my interview from Playboy. So it wasn't that Playboy was doing it incorrectly. It's the person who was interviewed as part of the Playboy interview feels that he was the actual source of the movie, which is alleged but not yet in discussion. I've only heard one side of this argument.
Right. And where is the limit of when can you base a movie on someone's life? Do you always have to get their approval?
Well, we have to decide whether it's about his life or not first. I mean, if you think about it, if the movie was not successful, there'd be no suit. So the first thing that happens is whenever you become successful, people come out of the woodwork to sue you. So the first is, does this have merit? And I don't know the answer to that question. And the second is, my understanding is that it was based upon the life story of someone different. If that is incorrect, then my sources is wrong. But that he is saying that without my permission, you based it on my life. And I think that it was based on somebody else's experiences. Oh, so that he is an uninvolved third party who's trying to sue. We'll have to see how that works out in the courts.
Yeah, there was some other controversy at the Oscars, too, where I guess in the documentary category or producer got up to accept, and then another female producer that had worked on the film with him, and she kind of like came in, pushed him out of the way. I don't know if you guys caught that or not.
I missed
that. That was bizarre.
So this was
very
for the Cove.
Strange.
This is for the Cove.
This is for documentary short. And
yeah, documentary
what happened
short.
Is two producers fell out on creative differences, and the producer that produced the film got up to accept the award, got 20 seconds into his statement, and a woman came on, pushed him away from the microphone, took over the microphone. She was one of the original producers and left about halfway through the pre-production phase because she had creative disagreements with how the film was being produced, and yet decided that what she was going to do is take over the Oscar stage and state her opinion.
Wow.
When it was very weird. Very
yeah,
weird.
Her opening line was something like, leave it to a man to not let a woman to talk, or something bizarre like that. It was really mm-hmm. kooky.
And this is a great way to ensure that you'll never work in Hollywood again.
Yeah, well, I don't think she came out looking good.
As someone who's used to work on movies, I always when you see people get up there and they start bad talking directors, and like I'd watch someone like bad talk. It was an article where they hammered on both Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, and I was kind of like, yeah, that's not going to turn out well. You know, and it's not so much that people really like. It's not like it's just an issue of no one wants to be them. What they're afraid of is that you now get seen as a loose cannon, and it doesn't matter what they think of the people that you're attacking in the press or in front of people. They just don't want to be the next one, you know, and that's, mm-hmm. and that is a great way to.
Well, she did a great job of ensuring she's going to have a hard time getting more work in the city. That's very true.
Yeah. She thought she wasn't, being listened to before, she should just so anyway we are out of time. I've got two great stories that we're going to just push into next week, talking about Hollywood pay and also the mathematics of a Hollywood blockbuster. So we're going to push those are they have a little bit of a time there, and we are out of time. So Tim, where can people find you?
OneTimStreet.com.
And Larry, where can people find you?
LarryJordan.biz, JORDAN.biz.
Mark, where can people find you?
BoingBoing.net.
Great. Thank you so much for a great conversation, guys. And to everyone else listening, this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.